You Take Yourself With You by Claire Yosa. Pre-release draft, chapter 2, The Truth in the Mirror. The last time I looked in this mirror, Dad was alive and I was free. I found it in a box of stuff I brought back from the farm last weekend. I'd been putting off going through it. I knew how much it would hurt. I'm back in my flat in Milan, shaving with Dad's old mirror. The one he had when he taught me to shave just 4 short years after Mum left. And I find another grey hair. I wince as I pull it out with a pair of tweezers that have been lurking in the back of the bathroom cabinet. I know I shouldn't care, it's vain. But I'm only in my mid-30s and it really shows when your hair is dark brown. Crow's feet garnish my mother's chestnut brown eyes like dill leaves on a salad. I didn't look like this a year ago. That was before. Tired eyes. A worry line forming between my eyebrows. My face is too thin. My skin's gone pale despite the Italian sun. And when did I last cook a proper meal? The kitchen in my flat in Milan is sterile and functional, barely used. It's too easy to grab food on the run in a city like this, and I can go weeks at a time not being here, travelling with work. White and black and stainless steel dominate. Tiles that are strangers to the splash of tomato passata. Worktops that have never made fresh pasta. An oven that prefers to reheat than to cook. Such a contrast to the warm chaos of Nonna's kitchen, my grandmother back at home on our cherry farm. There I'm welcomed by the smell of delicious food whatever time of day I arrive, and the shelves in the kitchen happily carry the weight of generations of pottery jugs, heavy-based pans, boxes of hidden luxuries. Wall and floor tiles in every shade of terracotta are stained with stories dripping with the laughter and worries and gossip of nearly 300 years. The room is dominated by a heavy old oak table, which my grandparents bought when they got married. It's strange to think my dad ate his first ever food at that table. You can still see the scratches he made with his first penknife. Shortly before Nonna showed him how much her biggest wooden spoon could hurt, allegedly leaving him unable to sit down for at least 2 days. It's strange to think that I ate my first meal there too, sitting on Mum's lap and stealing cherries from a bowl, causing blind panic when everyone thought I'd swallowed the cherry stone and would choke to death, only for them to find I'd already spat it out onto my baby white vest. And it's strange to think my parents ate their last meal together there, before Mum left. But that was too long ago. I was 10. I don't want to go there again. She was never mentioned by Dad or Nonna or anyone else at the farm after that evening. As though she'd never existed. But I was living proof that she had. I dry off my face with a comfortably soft towel and walk towards my kitchen. It's not far. Flats in central Milan aren't huge. Though I was fortunate when I bought this place, mine is larger than most. With a high ceiling and windows that actually let in a breeze when the sun is stifling, which is most of the summer. And I'm spared the incessant traffic noise by living up a quieter side street more useful for parking than driving, so the air is fresher here too. I make myself an espresso using Dad's battered old stovetop pot. Makes me chuckle when I see people spending hundreds of euros, if not thousands, on barista-quality home coffee-making machines. I prefer the results from this dented metal contraption, with all its history, that would cost less than 10 euros to replace. Yet it's irreplaceable. As the water hisses its way through the pot, the rim gently fills with that slow aroma of the perfect espresso. No rush, no queue, no paying extra for sitting down. I think about the nuances of how to make it, with just the right amount of coffee, compacted just the right amount with the right surface area, the right speed of the water and the steam, all controlled by the temperature of the hob. Rush it, and it's a weak disappointment. Too slow, and it's bitter and stewed. But I know I'm just distracting myself from other thoughts. I pour my drink into a small, bright blue china cup, ignoring the saucer, Nonna wouldn't approve, and take it to my sofa to sit and enjoy. I lean back with my feet on the coffee table. Its battered cherry wood is warm and friendly.
It looks out of place against the modern lines of the rest of my apartment. I rescued it from an old barn at the farm when I first bought this place. I wanted to bring a piece of home with me. I'd describe my flat more as functional than cosy, the exact opposite of the farm. But when you're working and travelling as much as I used to, you don't have time for fluffing cushions or arranging vases. I like the way it feels calm and clean here, with nothing I don't need. It's easier that way. I take the first delicious sip of the espresso. Perfect. Not bitter, not too strong, no sugar needed. The taste hits my nose before my tongue. But it doesn't change anything. Saturday. A day off. First time I can remember in, I can't remember how long. I don't know what to do with it. I feel like I'm bobbing at sea with no oars and no anchor, craving a breeze to give me direction. I'm not used to freedom like this, being able to choose no concrete mission. For years, I've worked all week and brought work home at weekends, on the rare weekends when I got to be in the city instead of at the farm. But Nonna kicked me out this weekend, told me I needed to go back to my old life. It's my first weekend in Milan since the accident. I don't want to be here, but I don't want to be at the farm either. I shouldn't be here. I don't mean the flat. When Dad's ancient Fiat left the road and flew down the hillside, I thought that was it. I felt the roof smash as we landed on it. My seatbelt pinned me back, crushing my ribs as it fought to protect me. We rolled. Just like we did as kids, when we would lie on our sides and roll down hillside meadows, out of control and crying with laughter and excitement, loving the thrill of it, before Mum left. But cars aren't meant to roll like that. Roof, side, wheels, side, roof. Somehow I knew Dad was dead even before I looked over at him. He wore his seatbelt loosely as a token gesture to road safety. Gravity, momentum and stubbornness killed him. I don't remember anything else until I was in the hospital, waking up in a white room with white sheets and white lights and white nurse uniforms and white-coated doctors. I laughed to myself at how it felt like waking up in a cliche of a comedy hospital heaven. Then eventually I remembered. No one will ever know what caused Dad to lose control on the bend he must have driven 1,000 times before. The weather was fine, the sun was hazy, the police found no trace of mud or oil that might have caused a skid. From what was left of the wheels, the tyres looked fine. I had been reviewing some financial figures, ready for the meeting we were heading to with the bank manager, to talk about getting a loan to rebuild the packing barn at the farm. Dad had been singing to an old song on the radio. Then suddenly we were flying, and he was gone. And now I'm sitting here alone with nothing to do and no one to talk to. Luca, my boss, gave me 2 months off to get over my injuries and sort out the mess that a person leaves behind when they don't know they're going to die. I had a few cracked ribs, a dislocated shoulder, whiplash, a few cuts and plenty of bruises, and a decent dose of concussion that meant they kept me unconscious for the first week. That last one was my fault. No one tells you when your car lands upside down and you take off your seatbelt that you'll land on your head. And it will hurt. The physical wounds healed soon enough, but the rest of it? It took weeks before I stopped waking up screaming, reliving the accident in slow motion, suffocating under the fear, racking my brain for anything I could have done to prevent it, wishing for a time machine. And it took a month before I could get back behind the wheel of my car. Luca suggested counselling, but what good would that do? There are too many boxes from my past I've carefully locked away, and I wasn't convinced that talking therapy was the way to keep them that way. I'm not ready to deal with them yet. I don't want to talk about it. Any of it. I sip more of my espresso and remember how things used to be back when I knew how to laugh. I used to have friends who, like me, loved to drive to the lakes and the mountains at weekends. We worked hard and played hard. We would go off-road mountain biking, risking our necks on treacherous descents that forced you to pay 100% attention to the slightest movement and change in the track, becoming one with your bike, and regularly being grateful for the safety gear we had all given in to wear. We'd hike for miles up hidden tracks that the tourists would never find and go swimming naked in secluded glacial lakes. We would climb rock faces and picnic on the cliffs before abseiling back down. One summer we all got addicted to base jumping, throwing ourselves off death-defying sheer drops with nothing but some nylon string and an over-ambitious sheet strapped to your back, better known as a parachute. The feeling of sheer terror as you jump is nearly instantly replaced by a profound sense of total peace and calm, a oneness with the air around you as you float and glide, and if you're lucky, catch a thermal to add a few precious moments to the exhilaration. The jumping bit was easy. The only tricking part was landing, which we usually got away with. Life was full of love, laughter, fun. Summer romances would consume your every waking moment, only to peter out before the first hot chocolate of autumn. But no one cared. We were so free. We felt so alive. Had I known those days were numbered, would I have appreciated them more? I'm not sure. We all started turning 30, and with each wedding I attended, another one left the group, never intending it to be permanent, until the christening started. And after a few years, I was the only one of us left. I'm not sure how it happened. It wasn't for want of trying. It would be unoriginal for me to say I never found the right woman, but I didn't. I thought I had with Isabella, but that was perhaps one of the worst calls I ever made. They all came to visit after Dad's funeral, which I missed while I was unconscious in hospital. I hadn't seen most of them in over a year. They all offered to help, but what can they do, really? I'm not even sure I know what I want. I feel the pressure of running the farm. Pietro has run the estate for years, decades, but he's a manager, not a decision maker. And he made it clear to me once the funeral was over. He runs a team of up to 20 people who come and go through the seasons, doing everything the farm asks of them. And now, paying their salaries, keeping a roof over their heads and shoes on their children's feet and food in their bellies is my job. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, drenched in icy cold sweat, wondering what will happen to them if I mess up. The fact that I survived and not Dad puts them at risk. It wasn't their fault that life chose me instead of him. I don't want them to have to pay if I make mistakes. And Nonna, Dad's mum, pretends she's as strong as an ox, but I know she's not. Not anymore. No woman should have to bury her husband and her child, or raise her grandson without his mother. But she's right, I need to get my life back. What's left of it? So I'm back to working in Milan, pretending that everything is okay, and I'm good at pretending. It's one of the reasons why Luca promoted me to lead the team. Pretending is a core part of our job. Except that the company's official term for it is building rapport, to gain confidences, to hear secrets, to solve riddles, and to make decisions that no one else wants to make. We're part of an international business consultancy, and clients call us in when they know they're just heartbeats away from having to close down. Maybe they need to restructure. Maybe someone has been fiddling the books. Maybe their product's market is dying and they need new innovations to survive. Finding the answers is our job. That secret solution you can only see when you're an outsider. I used to love it. Maybe one day I will again. Luca says he's got a new project for me, but this one is slightly different. Not a company, but a business in the southern Italian sense. It's going to be a stretch for us all and more dangerous than usual. I wish it would wake me up, drag me out of this stuckness. I want to feel excitement again, even if that means feeling fear too. I don't remember the last time I had fun. I need to find a way to get out of this rut. I need to feel the wind in my hair to blow away the dense cobwebs of pain and guilt, to remind myself there's more to the world than my worries. So I down the rest of my espresso and head to the door, grabbing my keys. I'm going to drive into the mountains a few hours outside the city and walk until I'm too tired to do anything else. I always keep an overnight bag in the boot of my car because I never know where I'm going to sleep if I'm in the middle of a case. So all I need to do is pick up my hiking boots from the lockup in the musty cellar from my block of flats and I'll be on the road. The sky is blue and cloudless once I escape the city. The roads are busy. The cars are crammed with families and bike racks. The good weather means everyone else in Milan has had the same idea. But they'll all be heading for Lake Como and the hills around it, to weekend homes and crowded restaurants and overpriced boat cruises and sunburnt tourists. I'm going an hour further up the valley, skirting Como via Lecco and heading past Sondrio into the start of the Alps. I remember the perfect spot where I can park the car and then walk for hours, uninterrupted, falling in love with those views all over again. Then it will be just me and the goats, alone with my thoughts for company, as usual.